harder to talk about pop as postmodernism. There is an understanding that postmodernism is not always critical, sort of laudatory or celebratory, without necessarily being, without really sort of criticizing something. This adoption of pop is therefore considered to be a sort of surrender, carnivalesque celebration of popular work, without the critical moment that you would might want from something like art. And I disagree with this. Pop art is oftentimes quite critical. The distinction pop art is different than the distinction pop music. Pop music is defined simply by that which is popular. If music is popular, it's pop music. If art is popular, it's not necessarily pop art.
Stand by, please. Rolling on six. On six.
This is Adam Scull. Welcome back to another episode of Art World Talks. Welcome back, everyone. Part two of our interview with Stephen Squibb.
On a basic level, you do have this pop, insofar as it's concerned with popular iconography, is anti-modern or postmodern because it's not abstract expressionist, it's minimalist or something. So that would be the sort of the cursory example. The other one, though, I think that's a little trickier and where it gets a little harder to talk about pop is postmodernism. There is an understanding that postmodernism is not always critical, that it's sort of laudatory or celebratory without really sort of criticizing something. This adoption of pop is therefore considered to be a sort of surrender or a carnivalesque celebration of popular work without the critical moment that you might want from something like art. And I disagree with this. Pop art is oftentimes quite critical. I think Andy Warhol was remarkably intelligent in the sort of way that he shaped his work around the sort of culture industry at large. I find it to be quite critical and quite suggestive, not in a classical sense, but in an unclassical sense. So in that respect, there is a modernist trend within pop art, which is this desire to push the discourse, to do something new, and to find new ways of articulating old ideas. And that strikes me as a very classically modern sensibility. And so I think with postmodernism and pop art, it's interesting because it sort of fits and it sort of doesn't, you know?
Also, with your interest and background in theater, could you tell us how you would apply that to the history of theater at the time of pop art?
That is another very interesting question, because so much of what is considered the postmodern moment, contemporary or visual art, is the becoming theatrical of art. And you see this, of course, most classically in Michael Fried's essay, the name of which is Art and Objecthood, where he basically is having a sort of hysterical fit about the becoming theatrical of sculpture. And it's amazing if you read the essay. It's a wonderful essay, but it is sort of deeply reactionary. And he's looking at minimalist sculpture and declaring it theatrical, which on a sort of very basic level is sort of absurd on its face. That said, his argument's very interesting, you know, where he says the thing about minimalist sculpture is that it invites the audience into the space. The relation of the audience to the sculpture is what is fundamentally at stake in minimalist sculpture, and this is what makes it fundamentally theatrical. And then he proceeds to offer some really gratuitous misreading of Brecht that I won't get into right now. That said, you have in a sort of contemporary art genre the becoming theatrical of work, the becoming performative of work. And you see this also in terms of theoretical trends. The emphasis on performativity as a sort of theoretical construct comes to the fore in the postmodern moment. So in theater itself, you have a sort of strange moment because everyone else is sort of borrowing theater's style. And so where does theater go from this? Well, first of all, you have the division into performance or performance art and theater. And these two things are now basically pretty separate. They very rarely overlap. So I think the first thing to note is you have these things being sectioned off, right? And so we have theater, and that's sort of the classic sense of theater. And then you have sort of performance, and that's sort of art theater, right? That said, you do have a really sort of a vanguardist moment in theater right around the 60s and the 70s with things like the Living Theater, Peter Brook. Certainly, you have the early works of Richard Foreman and Bob Wilson. So you do Pina Bausch, you know, Ariane Mnouchki, you do have the beginnings of a sort of a more classically complex theater. It is a sort of interesting question for all those reasons.
For the changing of what happens in pop art, how do you see that moving to today and people using it and taking from it, parallel or perhaps a part of what theater was doing?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about this term pop art, and actually I mentioned this in the article on Warhol that I published recently, is that the distinction pop art is different than the distinction pop music. Pop music is defined simply by that which is popular. If music is popular, it's pop music. If art is popular, it's not necessarily pop art. So there is within the actual term pop art another layer of description, and that is the focusing, as we've been talking about, on popular iconography or popular images. But because that designation makes sense to us, it signifies that there's always a distance between art and what is popular. Otherwise, there would be no need to designate pop art as different than anything else. So there is a sort of odd tension there, where art is sort of admitting that it's not popular. And that's why when it's talking about things that are popular, it has its own genre for that. And we call that pop art. Theater always believes or likes to believe that it's sort of fundamentally populist. And you see this certainly in Brecht, but even if you go back before the sort of advent of the televisual age, theater really was populist, truly. One of the great examples is the theatrical version of Uncle Tom's Cabin, which actually was seen by many, 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 many more millions of people who then ever read the book. And that piece of theater was very much responsible for the abolitionist movement. Now, after television, theater is sort of thrown into crisis. And after cinema, theater is sort of thrown into crisis because competing with these other forms. And so the history of theater in the same moment is to sort of develop its own life and its own vitality, separate from television and cinema, while also trying to maintain its commitment to being a populist form. A different version of pop in that respect. I'm not sure it succeeded, and it's certainly in a very precarious place right now, but I think those would be some ways of approaching that question.
A moment ago, you mentioned that your latest essay, referring to Andy, and is that Warhol's late expressionism essay?
Yes, that's the essay.
For those who may not realize it, Warhol's late expressionism is a contemplation by Stephen of a touring show at the Brooklyn Museum of Andy Warhol's late works. At the end of your review, Stephen, you interestingly say, specifically addressing your essay per se, but also what you're saying right now, you say that as always with an artist known for his tenets and his diversions, there is a risk in filling up the empty space of his intentions with a corresponding excess of conceptual strategy. That is really putting together all that you're telling us today.
That's a long sentence. It's so funny. I try to read out. You have this old writer trick of reading it out loud, you know, after you've written it to make sure that it reads all right. Sometimes I just don't know how I can live with myself writing these never-ending sentences. No, I think Warhol is obscure, and I think he is opaque, and I think he worked incredibly hard. We talk about theater and we talk about performance. I think Warhol's lifelong commitment to the performance of his life is really unparalleled, and his absolute discipline in crafting a certain presentation for himself is something that I remain totally in awe of. You know, I was thinking of Joaquin Phoenix situation. Joaquin Phoenix showed up on David Letterman about a year ago with a giant beard and sort of mumbling and muttering and being ridiculous. And he declared that he was giving up acting to become a rap star. And it turned out that this actually was a committed performance that he and Casey Affleck were doing for about a year and a half so Casey could make this documentary about the sort of fall from grace of Joaquin Phoenix. Supposedly, the only people who knew it was going on were him and Casey and his agent. He had to call up his agent and say, we're going to do this crazy performance. It might be the end of my career, but, you know, and the agent, to his credit, got on board. Now, I suspect more people knew about it, but it was surprising enough that, you know, it made the head of the Art Globe art section when Casey came out and admitted this whole thing was an act. And I was thinking, you know, what a sort of interesting thing that was, and what a sort of compelling thing for these two people to do. But also, they clearly hadn't done their research on Warhol. Because what Warhol teaches us is that the idea of truth and falseness doesn't operate in the sort of spectacular sphere or the cultural sphere in the same way, to the point where it's actually impossible to present yourself with anything like authenticity, such as the nature of the short newspaper article, the interview, the short television spot, that there is an incommensurability between who we are really, quote unquote, and what of ourselves gets presented. And Warhol tried to highlight this by living entirely within these small spaces of presentation. And so he begged the question for anyone interacting with him of what presentation meant. So for Casey Affleck to come out and say, oh no, Joaquin Phoenix was just kidding, he's misunderstanding something that Warhol understood implicitly, which is that there is no such distinction at the level of everyday life for those of us looking up at these famous people.
Your article, Warhol's Last Expressionism, you're dealing with theoretical issues of the idea of expressionism itself. Dorno called the rhetoric of expressionism. Could you explain to our listeners and how it applies to the show?
Warhol's late expressionism was in some sense designed to be somewhat incendiary, as much as theoretical things can ever be incendiary. Insofar as Warhol is considered, and I think justly considered, a great opponent of abstract expressionism, which of course was the dominant trend right before he came to the sort of attention of the art world. Expressionism has a fascinating history, because every time it has appeared, by sort of what I mean by expressionism is a sort of emphasis on subjectivism, a sort of real emphasis on personal vision. The sort of classic example would be, Munch's Scream, right? Is your sort of archetypal expressionist work. It's very vivid, it's very visceral, and it's very unique. It's a personal statement about being sort of trapped in your own space. You know, this is expressionism. This is a personal vision being offered. Every time that has shown up, it has been criticized as being either apolitical, sometimes even more explicitly as being pro-fascist. And what was striking to me about looking at Warhol as the sort of following abstract expressionism in the same way that, you know, certain trends of realism followed the first expressionism, is that he seems to be performing in his own strange way a version of this sort of critique of expressionism as fascist. Now, that sounds like a lot. Certainly Warhol was not saying that Rauschenberg was a fascist. I don't mean to say that. But what I do mean to say is that in his work, he is examining critically the effect of that kind of work once it leaves the artist's studio, it enters into the world. And he is drawing a diagram for us and showing how it is this art is absorbed within the sort of political reality of the moment. And that the pretension of the expressionist moment, the belief that one's personal vision can survive that act of translation, is fundamentally naive and borderline dangerous. And I think that is one of the things that Warhol gives us, and that is a version of this earlier critique of expressionism. So that is sort of the background of that Adorno quote. If you want, I can go on and explain why I think he became an expressionist at the end of his life.
I hope you've enjoyed part two of our discussion with Stephen Squibb. Please help grow this new arts community by leaving a comment on the page of any podcast you may have enjoyed, or sending in an email to leave your opinion. Our email address is artworldtalks@gmail.com. I hope you will join me next time for another episode of Art World Talks.